we're looking back at the chain reaction car pileup that we saw on Sunday and what we can learn from it. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That crash on Interstate 41 in Neenah is the worst, or at least one of the worst crashes in Wisconsin history in terms of the number of cars and people involved. Were you out on the road Sunday? What were the conditions and how did you stay safe and alert? What questions do you have about handling winter road conditions? And what questions do you have for Wisconsin State Patrol? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sergeant Clint Beck is with the Wisconsin State Patrol Northeast Region. Sergeant Beck, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
So take us back to Sunday. What were the conditions like, and what were we seeing out there on the roads?
Sure. Earlier in the morning, we had some rain. Actually, the night before, we had some pretty heavy rain. And then that cold air rushed in and turned everything to snow. So with that cold air, rain, and snow, the road conditions deteriorated very quickly. At approximately 11:15, some portions of I-41 throughout the Northeast region was actually in pretty decent shape. It's when the wind started to pick up at about 40, gusts up to 60 miles per hour is when the problem started to occur.
And then there were some visibility issues, whiteout conditions. What do we know about that?
Yeah, with the light snow that we received and the 40 to 60 mile an hour winds, yeah, the wind picked up that snow and caused some very significant whiteout conditions, which, of course, contributed to the crash we're discussing now.
And so you were perhaps then seeing crashes going on as these road conditions were worsening. Were there accidents throughout the region on other interstates, or was it this one major pileup?
No, we were responding all day to vehicles in the ditch. Some just ran in a ditch and just got pulled out and were on their way. Others were, you know, disabling damage and injury crashes. So it was pretty much started right away in the morning when traffic started to pick up.
So there was this 131 vehicle pileup on Interstate 41. How does a pileup happen? Can you explain how these start?
Well, it starts out in this instant, we're not sure what happened, but it starts out with one or two vehicles, maybe a spin out, maybe lost control, is now in the lane of travel. Now we have whiteout conditions, so vehicles traveling on the interstate are not seeing anything in front of it. I guess visibility, to some extent, when I was talking to some of the other troopers, sergeants, inspectors, you couldn't see the front of your hood. So you have a vehicle that's spun out in the lane of traffic, and you can't see 10 feet in front of you, and all of a sudden, there's the vehicle. And what do? You try to brake, steer out of the way. Well, you lose control. You might hit that person, and then so on and so forth. But every car behind you does the same exact thing. They just couldn't see. The whiteout conditions were a very significant contributing factor to this crash.
And so we know 131 cars were involved. Can you estimate how many more were stranded on the interstate behind the accident?
The estimate right now is right around 500 cars and semi-units were stranded behind that 131-car pileup. From the time the crash started to the time we detoured 41 southbound, yeah, there was about 500 vehicles.
How do troopers, how does Wisconsin prepare for events like this?
Well, it's all about planning. I mean, it's not just State Patrol. It's all the other county municipalities. We work as one team. This is a perfect example of what happens when a multi-vehicle crash, such as what we had on Sunday, occurs. We all come together. It doesn't matter what patch you're wearing. We all have one goal in mind, and that is to, one, protect the scene so nothing else happens, and then, two, get to the people involved in any crash as soon as possible to assess them and get ambulance if needed, transportation, and then at that point the recovery begins. So it's everything from troopers, deputies, police officers to tow truck drivers, plow drivers to tow trucks. So it's everything in one big ball, I guess you could say.
And how does communication work through events like this? Because you have multiple different agencies, and then you have this layer. I mean, I didn't even think you have to be also connecting with tow trucks on this as well. How does transportation or communication work?
Well, without getting into logistics of things, it's called the Incident Command System. It's an ICS. It's set up for incidents just like this. So when a crash like this occurred on Sunday, there was a, let's say, a headquarters or a command post somewhere where all different agency, head agency officials meet. At that point, they're talking to one another and then deciding who's going to take care of the recovery issue, who's going to take care of transportation of these people. So what happens is one person is calling, let's say, Winnebago Dispatch 911 Center or State Patrol 911 Center and telling them, hey, we're responsible for tow trucks. We need this, 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 and this. And then, like, the Winnebago County Sheriff's Department Dispatch would be in charge of, let's say, getting people out of the scene, so trying to figure out who can help us transport. So we're not duplicating our efforts. It's going as smoothly as possible.
We're talking with Sergeant Clint Beck. He is with the Wisconsin State Patrol Northeast Region. We're looking back on that huge crash on Sunday, that pileup with 131 vehicles. Only one fatality, though, which was pretty remarkable, Sergeant Beck. Do you think that to get away from a crash this size and to only have one fatality?
Yeah, one fatality is one too many, I mean, that's for sure. It could have gone a lot worse. So, yes, I consider everybody pretty lucky that, you know, there was only 71 people injured with that one fatality. But, again, that one fatality is one too many on Wisconsin highways.
So I know we're only a few days out or so, but does the Wisconsin State Patrol and other agencies involved plan to assess the response to Sunday's incident? Was it major enough where you could kind of debrief on it?
Winnebago County Sheriff's Department is in charge of actually investigating the crash, and we don't know exactly what happened. I think once we figure out what exactly happened, there will be a debrief. I mean, that might be a few months, so in between, I'm sure there's going to be a debrief on what can we do better, what can, you know, how can we as an agency with the patrol and the sheriff's department and city municipalities, how can we do things better? We're always looking to improve, and that is what the major thing behind debriefing is how can we improve our past actions.
Sergeant Beck, what can drivers do? What should drivers consider during these winter driving conditions? How can we be safe, drivers?
Well, always stay informed with the latest weather conditions. I know the Weather Service did put out a lot of advisories and watches and warnings. So if you can postpone a trip where you don't need to get somewhere, that is the best thing a person can do, is don't even be on the roads. However, if you are out on the roads, you know, remember the rapid changing weather conditions. Just like we had on Sunday, some of the roads were clear, and all of a sudden the next second you had whiteout conditions. And you have to adjust your driving around those different weather conditions. The big thing is to slow down, create some following distance between the vehicle in front of you so you do have time to stop if something would happen. Always wear your seatbelt. Make sure you're not distracted by, you know, texting or talking on the phone. You got to have your full, you just got to be aware of everything around you. So you don't need to be talking on the phone or, you know, playing on the radio. Make sure you have your low beam lights on and always give yourself extra travel time so you're not in that hurry to get to your destination or to get home.
Well, Sergeant Beck, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Sergeant Clint Beck is with the Wisconsin State Patrol Northeast Region. Coming up, the unsolved murder of a Wisconsin priest is the subject of the latest season of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's True Crime Podcast. We'll dig into the case. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the podcast Unsolved here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's podcast looks at real-life mysteries, uncovering new clues about unsolved murders. And there's a new season to talk about, and it zooms in on March 4th, 1998. That is when Father Alfred Coons, the priest for St. Michael's Catholic Church in the village of Dane, was found dead. Matt Abbott covered the case. He says a lot of Father Coons' secrets, which the podcast has been digging into, still haven't been fully explained. And here's Abbott from the first episode of this season's Unsolved.
My gosh, here on the surface, you think you have, oh, what a bunch of holy men. And then underneath the surface, you have a lot of dirty things going on, and that added another element of intrigue to the Father Coons murder investigation.
What questions do you have about the case of Father Alfred Coons? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Gina Barton is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter. She's author of the book Fatal Identity and host of the Unsolved podcast. Gina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are in the third season of Unsolved. What led to the creation of this series?
I've always enjoyed writing true crime narratives and reading them and watching them on TV and listening to shows about them. And so back in 2015, a detective in Hale's Corners came to me with the story that would be the first season of Unsolved, about a missing teenager named John Zara who disappeared from high school one day. He was great. He was cooperative. He gave me all the documents. And then a colleague of mine asked me if I had heard Serial. Now, at that point, I hadn't heard Serial, the original true crime podcast. but I listened, and I said, boy, that's something we can do. And that's how the series started.
Right, because Wisconsin doesn't have a shortage of unsolved cases. What led you to select the Father Coons case?
There are so many unsolved murders in Wisconsin. It's really incredible how many there are. I always need three things when I'm choosing a season. And in the Father Coons case, several listeners who had heard seasons one and two, including Matt Abbott, who you just heard that clip from, came to me and said, hey, have you looked at this homicide of Father Coons? And once I started digging into it, I realized I had the three things that I needed, and that was cooperation from law enforcement, cooperation from the family or friends of the victim, and at least some documents to verify what people were saying.
Tell us about him. Who was he?
Father Coons, when he was murdered, was 67 years old. He was the parish priest in the very small village of Dane, Wisconsin, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. And he was a very interesting and polarizing figure. He was full of contradictions. So he practiced the Latin Mass and preached strict adherence to the Ten Commandments. But then later, the police found out that he was actually having affairs with women, which is not only a violation of one of the commandments, but also a violation of his priestly vows. He ran the place kind of with an iron fist and got rid of people who disagreed with him. Like, there were nuns running the school, and so he told them to leave, and they ended up having to leave not only the church, but also they left town. But then at the same time, he would leave the church doors unlocked for homeless people to come in and stay.
So you talked with lots and lots of people. How did you build this whole story around him? And what did you try to unlock here?
The thing about this story and some of the other seasons of the show that I've done is that there are so many suspects. It's really an example of the truth being stranger than fiction. So I try to first paint a portrait of the victim, a three-dimensional portrait. And in Father Coons' case, that was easier than in some of the past seasons because he himself had done a radio show. And so I had 7.5 hours of tape of him, you know, sharing his thoughts, his philosophy, his ideas about religion. And then delved into as many suspects as I could.
How were they received by you when you come knocking? What do you say? And as to trying, what you're trying to do, and do they open up to you?
You know, I'm always worried that they're not going to, but in most cases they do. There was one guy who will be coming up on episode 9 who was a suspect because he was having an affair with this woman who Father Coons had kind of mentored, and she confessed to him, and he told her, you know, you shouldn't be having sex outside of marriage. And so I went and knocked on this guy's door. It was a very remote area. And even when I talked to the police about it, they were like, did you go armed to talk to him? When we went to talk to him, we were afraid he was going to, like, snipe us through the trees. But no, you know, knocked on his door, very willing to talk, invited us in and talked for 2 hours about how upset and angry he was that the police had treated him as a suspect in the first place.
We're talking with Gina Barton. She is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter and host of the Unsolved podcast. We're talking about Unsolved. Gina, are we any closer to solving this crime?
I think we might be. In 2011, the sheriff's department there in Dane County found a new partial DNA profile on the evidence. So it's very interesting whether this profile belongs to the killer or not. They're not sure, but that's a piece of evidence that they had before that they didn't have, obviously, 10 or 20 years ago. Also, sometimes the passage of time is a disadvantage in cold cases. Witnesses die, cops retire. But sometimes the passage of time changes the relationship between the suspect and a friend or a loved one or somebody they've talked to about the crime. So I think both of those things could possibly come into play here.
What are you hearing from readers and listeners when it comes to the interest in true crime?
The interest in true crime is just off the charts. People want to know what's going on behind the scenes when law enforcement is investigating a murder. And they also want to feel like maybe they can be the one who helps break the case. So this season already, I've gotten several calls from people who knew Father Coons or who suspected a certain motive in his murder or who somehow had ties to one of the suspects. So I think the publicity really brings people out and does cause them to come forward with information.
Well, it's interesting because you would think that you would have a whole season of Unsolved ready to go, but as the season unfolds for your listeners, more things come out. Perhaps you make more connections, more people want to talk.
It's really true. I mean, my goal is always to have the first season completely done before we air the first one. But that never happens. So I'm still in the process of writing the final episode right now, which will air at the end of March. And that's because people have come forward with new information that I feel like listeners deserve to hear.
Are there any downsides to true crime? Are there any challenges to trying to cover something that's part of a genre that's become culturally popular?
Well, I think one of the downsides is that although we had talked earlier about how there are so many unsolved homicides in Wisconsin, you really have to pick the right case. You have to ask yourself what's different about this case, what's particularly interesting about this case, because when you have so many out there, if you just have one case and one suspect, it's not going to hold people's interest. So I think that's one of the challenges for sure.
What do you like about covering true crime? What draws you to it?
The people that you meet are so much more interesting than anyone you could dream up. You know, if I had written this podcast as fiction, people wouldn't want to listen to it because they would think it was just too far out in left field, that, like, it was too unreal and crazy. And actually, it really happened. So I'm always interested in why people do the things they do, why people react to certain situations the way they do, and just getting to know people who have been traumatized by situations that are difficult has always been really interesting to me as well.
As we wrap up here, what's next for Unsolved after this season? Do you know?
As has happened in the past seasons, I've already gotten several calls and emails about people telling me that next case I should look into. So as soon as we wrap this one up and hopefully solve it, I'll be pursuing some of those stories to figure out which one really has the elements that we're looking for season four.
Gina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Gina Barton is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter, author of the book Fatal Identity, and host of the Unsolved podcast. You can find a link to the podcast on the morning show page at WPR.org. Up next, it's news. Then, is there a gender pay gap among the nation's highest earners? We'll take a look at that with a sociologist here on the morning show on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the gender pay gap now and what we can learn from the nation's highest earners. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The fact is, there is an enormous gender wage gap here in the U.S. for workers at every stage in their careers, and it only gets worse with age. The wage gap accelerates for workers in their 30s and 40s, and we're going to peer into the very, very top tier of incomes to find out what we can learn more broadly about the gender pay gap. And a new report finds that women's income is sufficient for 1% status in only 1 in 20 of all elite households. So where do we see a fix for the gender pay gap across all class levels? Is it in more affordable childcare, perhaps a restructuring of social norms, more parity in the workplace? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jill Yavorsky is an assistant professor of sociology and organizational science at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. And she recently co-authored this study published in the American Sociological Review. It's titled Women in the 1% Gender Dynamics in Top Income Positions. Jill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why did you and your colleagues decide to focus on the gender dynamics at play in the top 1% of the U.S. income distribution? Because we know the top 1% has a lot to do with men and not few women. So what could we learn there?
Well, a lot of the previous research has more focused on this glass ceiling of that women have been largely excluded from leadership positions. And so kind of our broader interest was understanding, well, is the glass ceiling more extensive than just top leadership positions, but rather does it extend to nearly all high income positions? And ultimately that's what we find is really that the glass ceiling excludes women from a much broader array of occupations that could lead to top income.
And how are we defining 1% here? What do you have to earn to be categorized as top 1%?
So in order to be in a top 1% household, a household needs to bring in about $845,000. And so this was also part of the impetus for the study is that most scholars, as well as journalists, were oftentimes conceptualizing top 1% households as this joint or shared household status, of which in many respects it is. But we thought that it was important if we actually understood whose income, men's or women's, is really driving the household status, because this likely has strong implications for who is exercising the vast majority of political and economic influence that we know is so associated with being part of a top 1% household.
So did you look at trend lines over the long term? Has there always been this big gap at the 1% when you look at these elite households?
Yes. Yeah, so we did look at whether or not women were any more likely to personally earn 1% status based on their own income over the past 20 years. So we looked at from starting at 1995 to 2016. And largely we find that women have made very little progress in that they are no more likely today to personally earn 1% income than they were in the mid-1990s.
And you found that married women were 991% more likely than single women to be in the 1%. So certainly marriage there and your spouse having a lot to do about whether you're in that 1%.
Yes, absolutely. So this was one of the major findings, right, which definitely shows that due to a variety of labor market inequalities that still persist, that really women's main route to top 1% households is still through marriage, oftentimes marriage to men who have good earning prospects and have high education and are maybe self-employed.
So when you look across all socioeconomic backgrounds, do you see this kind of earning discrepancy among men and women across backgrounds?
So the gender gap definitely varies based on what part of the income distribution that you're talking about.
Okay.
So our study, relative to other studies that have looked at across the income distribution, suggests that the gender gap is even higher among these high-earning positions. So men and women actually in the more middle income distribution have made significant progress in closing the gender gap in that their incomes now look more similar to their husband's income, and that women in middle-class families are contributing a significant portion of the income in these families. And so this is where we've actually seen very little closing of the gender gap at the very high end. And this is in part because men's income have been ballooning, specifically around the top 1%, at such an exceedingly rate that women are essentially swimming upward, that they can't catch up.
But you also look at the women contributing to the male, to their spouse's ascent. There's a lot of things that are getting done in the background that perhaps that spouse isn't having to worry about so that they can make that rise.
Yes. So this is a great point and one that is extremely important to recognize in that a lot of some of the inequality that we see is, can be attributed to the fact that men do have greater access to women's unpaid labor, specifically that women still take on the majority of childcare and housework that really frees men's time to be able to devote more to their workplace. That I think that that the patterns would be different if we had more equal sharing of childcare and housework among couples.
Jill Yavorsky is with us. She is an assistant professor of sociology and organizational science at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, and she recently co-authored a study published in the American Sociological Review. It's titled Women in the 1% Gender Dynamics in Top Income Positions. Where do you see a fix for the gender pay gap across all class levels? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Jill, from your sociological perspective, when you look at income levels, the upper class, the middle class, the lower income tax brackets, do we see these different levels of progress as far as closing the gender pay gap? And specifically looking at lower and lower middle income women, where are they right now?
Yeah, so more generally, the pay gap is about 80 cents for a white man's dollar, so about a 20% gap. And the wage gap used to be largest among more working class and middle class women than it was at the top. Right now, we've seen the least amount of progress, particularly in the top 10% of closing the gender gap. But I want to say that a lot of this inequality stems from the fact that men and women still work in different and typically unequal jobs. So a lot of people know about within wage inequality, so men and women doing the same job but being paid differently. And that's an important factor. But there's this other important factor called between job inequality, that when we look at female-dominated jobs compared to male-dominated jobs, that female-dominated jobs tend to pay a whole lot less and have fewer benefits associated with them. And this is even when you control for the complexity of job and the education and training required for these jobs. So this is when you look at more comparable jobs, male-dominated jobs tend to pay more. And this is true kind of across the spectrum, that as more women are occupied, occupy a job, that the wages start to decrease. So this is also about valuing different types of work more equally among men and women.
You also looked into self-employment, and that self-employment is more important for women than men when it comes to increasing their likelihood to rise to even a one percenter. What do you find there?
Yeah, so this was a really striking finding, that self-employed women have odds that are 30 times higher of personally earning 1% income than non-self-employed women. And so although our study doesn't look at the mechanisms behind it, we can certainly draw on other research that this likely suggests that really ambitious and capable women are facing strong hurdles in rising through the corporate ranks, that they ultimately need to leave the corporate sphere and start their own business if they have any goals of reaching top echelons or reaching the top status that they may be seeking. And so we know that this is true in terms of huge promotion gaps, as well as other gender biases that women face.
Let's go to Marty now, joining us from Whitewater. Marty, what are your thoughts here?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, several years ago, I've got two sons, and they made some comment to me one day, like, you know, well, come on, Dad, you know, you make all the money. And I had a bring to shine a light on them that for what your mother does, you know, for the house, for the family, all the chores, the salary would be expected to be somewhere around $110,000 to $130,000. This was several years ago. I don't know, is there an updated figure now as to what a woman's salary would be for what she does around the house? And I'll listen to the response off air. Thank you.
So a spouse who is staying home and picking up all of these different tasks at home, do we put a dollar amount on that? Do we know?
I think that we know less about what that actually would look like, but I think it brings up a broader important point about the fact that we really don't value the amount of unpaid labor that women do, and that this also has broader implications for their labor market participation. So this is a great point that we also need to stress, that men and women should more equally participate in childcare and housework. And this is something that men and women both want. They both state that they want more egalitarian relationships. What happens is that after having a child, that typically couples will fall back onto gender norms, in which women will take on the majority of childcare and housework, often to the detriment of their careers.
Talking with Jill Yavorsky, co-author of the study published in the American Sociological Review. She's an assistant professor of sociology and organizational science at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. You can join in 800-642-1234. When we talk about the gender gap, how would you, or how do you actively right now address it? What choices have you made in your life that perhaps impact this gap? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at new sociological data out on the gender pay gap, talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And when we talk about the median pay gap, that's the median pay of women working full-time versus men working full-time. And women in the U.S., for example, make 80 cents on the dollar versus men on this particular basis. And we're looking at this gap through the lens of top earners with a new report out on women in the 1%. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the numbers showing that women's incomes account for a small percentage of 1% earners? And 1%ers aside, what do the study's findings tell you about the challenges that still persist for women in the workforce? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR. our mornings. Jill Yavorsky is an assistant professor of sociology and organizational science at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. She co-authored this study. And let's go to the phones now with Jill joining us from Portage. Jill, hi. I'm sorry, Julie. Julie, hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Julie.
Yes. So I guess the thing that I would like to say is just that I have an advanced degree, and I have chosen to really, over the years, put my family first and not focus on career as much. And my husband has been very supportive of that, and I really feel like that was my choice, and I know a lot of other women that have made that choice. And I really feel like this attitude that what our goal should be is that everything should be equal as far as money. It should be more that, like, our goal should be women should be able to make the choices that they want to make. And I feel like that sometimes when I listen to these discussions, I feel like women getting to make the choices they want to make and to live the life they want to live is really pushed out the door.
Oh, and sorry, Julie, that we just got cut off there. Jill, I think we heard enough, though, to kind of respond about choices.
Sure. Yeah, this is a great point. And this is that many women, you know, may not want to prioritize their career and take a stronger lead in their family. And that's certainly that women should, you know, a choice that women should be able to make. Some of the broader research on this suggests that it's oftentimes a constrained choice. That for some women who would like to stay, you know, strong within their careers, they oftentimes can't negotiate their partner to do their fair share of housework or childcare, for example. So I'll provide a quick example of this. My colleagues and I, Sarah Shop Sullivan, Claire Camp Dush, did a study about 180 couples who were having a baby, and it looked at pre and post transition to parenthood. And basically, the vast majority of these couples stated before having a baby that they wanted to split the childcare evenly, and that they had really egalitarian intentions. And kind of what happened across the transition to parenthood is that men dropped their housework by about 5 hours. Women's housework remained the same, and then women took on the majority of childcare. And this is 9 months, so we're not talking about breastfeeding, but we're really talking about the care of the child. And so many women, of course, get, you know, great enjoyment out of childcare. But we also know that relationship satisfaction increases when partners are more egalitarian. Of course, there's, you know, this is on average. So there are these choices that, of course, if women want to make that choice to prioritize their family, that's great. But for some other women, oftentimes it's a constrained choice that they're oftentimes not able to negotiate either with their workplace in order to have more family, you know, flexible hours, and they're not able to necessarily negotiate with their partner. So it's kind of twofold.
Let's go to Mike now, joining us from La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I really have a couple of questions. The first question is, I'm curious about the data, where it came from, just because I have an advanced degree where I had to do research, and that was a very important thing to me. And the other piece is, I work for a company in the Charlotte area, and the company I work for has a unique program called Paradigm for Parity, and we've joined that accord to have 50% of our executive positions by the year 2030 represented by women. And I'm just curious if professor is familiar with that, and if the data sources come from companies like that that are really doing progressive things to equal out not only the pay gap but also the gender gap in executive positions. And thank you for taking my call. I'll take a listen offline.
Yeah, so thanks for asking about the data. So it comes from the Survey of Consumer Finance, which is through the Federal Reserve Board. So this is a really high quality, nationally representative sample. And the reason that we used it specifically is because it oversamples people at the top 1%. And this is important because this group is so small that it makes it difficult to study if it's not oversampled. And it has really rich, detailed financial information. So we're able to look at not just wages, but total income. So income that comes from business as well as investment income. And then as for his other question, I'm not familiar specifically with the
Paradigm
company that he was...
that
he was referring to. But he is right that there are some companies that are taking a more proactive measure on trying to build the pipeline of women and really promote more women to the top.
Let's go to Spencer now in West Bend with thoughts on this. Spencer, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your subject matter expert. And is she at all familiar with Jordan B. Peterson? Because he explains the reason for any pay gap in the genders, and he attributes it to, you know, biological and psychological mechanisms that are inherent in men and women, such as women have a higher, not much higher, but just if you took everybody in the world and basically looked at who is highest on the most agreeable scale, women are the highest on the agreeability, I guess you'd call it, and versus men are not agreeable. So like when they're negotiating for wages or looking for the job that they're going to be working in, they tend to look for the more competitive and are less, they're less agreeable. So when somebody says, yeah, would you work for $5 an hour? The male is always going to ask for 10 versus the female is possibly going to say that's okay.
So is there something biological going on here?
Well, I can speak to a little bit of some of the research, not necessarily on the biological piece. I won't get into that, but whether or not men are more likely to negotiate or go for more competitive jobs. So Francine Blau and Lawrence Kahn, which are two economists, have looked at and tried to quantify how much is negotiation and some of these other skills, competitiveness, contributing to the pay gap. And ultimately, they think that it's a smaller part of the pay gap, that actually what is the main source of this wage gap is that men and women tend to work in different and unequal jobs. So what I was talking about earlier in that female-dominated jobs tend to pay less than comparable male-dominated jobs. And so this devaluation of care work in particular, because women are more likely to be in, you know, things like nursing or things associated around with care, that those jobs suffer a distinct wage penalty. And so some of the more recent work on negotiation suggests that men and women are actually now negotiating in pretty comparable numbers. So when you look at surveys that ask men and women, did you negotiate or try to negotiate for your last job, men and women are pretty actually similar to those, to people who report that they did. Now, what's notable is that research still shows that there may be a double bind associated with women negotiating, that when women negotiate, experimental lab research has shown that people judge them as less likable and judge them as less wanting to be coworkers with them. So it suggests that also when women do act in aggressive ways, that they still suffer or can suffer a likability penalty that doesn't affect men.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us and explaining this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jill Yavorsky is an assistant professor of sociology and organizational science at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, and she co-authored a new study published in the American Sociological Review that looks at the gender pay gap and specifically what we know from the 1%. Just ahead, from tipping to the 8-hour workday, we talk curious pocketbook issues with an editor from Planet Money. And then after 9, former lawyer for President Trump Michael Cohen will testify before the U.S. House of Representatives Oversight Committee. Tune in to the Ideas Network and WPR.org for live coverage there. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.